I'm going to step off the land then. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
In the hour to come, we'll find out what was behind those famous words and what their implications are today. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. What were the technological and political developments that led to the moon landings, and what developments have followed them? We'll find out from former NASA chief historian Roger D. Lanius. His book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings, was published in 2019 by Smithsonian Books. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
The politics are often talked about in terms of what led up to the moon landing, of course, the space race. And was it really sparked the whole thing by Sputnik in 1957, or do we need to go back all the way to 1945 and the end of World War II when those German rocket scientists were apportioned out informally between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Yeah, you really need to go back a little farther than Sputnik. The Cold War, that of course was a very broad rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, is the central character in this whole story. And without that Cold War rivalry, we would never have undertaken this program to reach the moon by the end of the decade. The Soviet Union would never have undertaken its similar efforts to best the Americans. And so you can't divorce it from that World War II ending and the beginning of the Cold War.
Was there a kind of a rocket rivalry before the idea of this space race then between the U.S. and the Soviet Union?
Oh, absolutely. Both the Americans and the Soviets were working on ballistic missiles, and that really is what sparked it. And of course, the most sophisticated technology that existed in the world in 1945 came from Nazi Germany. And the Wernher von Braun rocket team that had developed the V-2, a number of them, including Wernher von Braun, came to America, but a number of them also were spirited off to the Soviet Union and contributed to that program. And that race for a ballistic missile was the bottom line here. And, of course, beginning in the later 1950s, both sides developed those ballistic missiles. But missiles don't care. The rockets don't care what you use them for. You can use them to kill people and break things. You can also use them to put satellites and ultimately people into orbit.
Was Wernher von Braun interested in space?
Oh, absolutely. From the time he was a little boy, he'd been interested in space. Like, he read the science fiction of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and he was sort of jazzed by the ideas of going to the moon. And clearly, that's what drove him to work on amateur rocket programs in the 1920s. Of course, in the 1930s, he went to work for the German army and started building what became ultimately the V-2.
Eisenhower was faulted by Kennedy as not really doing enough in terms of sponsoring, initiating a program that would turn into a space program. Was that really a fair criticism?
Oh, it was, and actually you could go much farther. You know, Eisenhower did spend some serious money on space technology, but it was all built around the idea of let's build a ballistic missile and let's put up spy satellites that can find out what the Soviet Union is doing. But he had no interest whatsoever in the scientific satellite program to learn more about the Earth and ultimately the planets. He really believed that the human spaceflight program was a waste of effort. And he was sort of brought to the support of the very nascent part of that with NASA in the latter 1950s, only because he was beat up pretty badly in the political environment at the time. And the Democrats, led by Lyndon Johnson, I might add, were really after him on that score. And they wanted a more aggressive effort for peaceful uses of space. and also obviously the national security components as well.
Now, the Soviets obviously were early on interested in putting life forms into space, starting with a dog, Sputnik.
Right.
But not long after that, Yuri Gagarin going into space. What were they interested in?
Well, I mean, they also wanted to build ballistic missiles, and that was a big part of what they were doing. And the R-7 rocket that was used to launch the Sputnik satellites into orbit, and ultimately a more enhanced version of that, Yuri Gagarin, in 1961, started its life as a ballistic missile. Now, it was a lousy ballistic missile. It had limited capabilities. It couldn't guide it very well. It took forever to fuel. It was never going to be a good deployable ballistic missile, but it could launch a payload into space, and it had a very large payload capacity, so it could put up a pretty good sized satellite and ultimately a human being.
And he goes up in 1961, and that was the year in which Kennedy was taking office. What's the chemistry there between those events in the Soviet Union, those space accomplishments, and Kennedy?
Yeah. You know, neither political leader, neither the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, or in the United States, John Kennedy, was terribly committed to these sorts of ideas and concepts and space exploration as an end in and of itself. They were willing to put a little bit of money into it, but when they got the return of publicity that resulted from it, Khrushchev especially was very surprised by the response to Gagarin in April of 1961. And he probably shouldn't have been, but he was sort of taken aback by this fellow who went into space becomes a world hero. Now, Gagarin was really good as sort of a public relations figure. He was handsome. He was glib. He was articulate. He smiled and so on and so forth. So he looked good as a representative of the Soviet Union. And that's what Khrushchev decided was really important. And after that happened, he went back to his chief designer, whose name was secret in the West at that point, Sergei Korolev. And he said, hey, can you do more? What else can we do? And a whole series of efforts flowed from that particular undertaking. In the United States, you've got a response to that. Kennedy sees what happens with Gagarin and this tremendous Soviet success. And within a week of that launch, the Bay of Pigs disaster takes place, in which American-backed Cuban rebels land at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba and try to overthrow Castro. With horrendous consequences.
And a big failure.
You've got a Soviet success, and almost on its heels, an American failure. And at that point, Kennedy says, I got to do something to change the subject. And the result of that was a decision to go to the moon.
And was there really any practical goal in mind for going to the moon? As far as Kennedy was concerned, at least, or for that matter, a lot of people in the space community?
Well, there were several goals, and they were successful in achieving them. The first goal from Kennedy's standpoint was, okay, we have to do something to respond to the Soviet Union. But what is that something? And the decision to go to the moon is the result of that. He gained enormous political advantage in announcing that decision. So his short-term objectives were achieved there. He also wanted it to be a long-term enough goal that with concerted effort over a period of years, the Americans would be able to be successful. Short-term, they'd been beaten every time they turned around by the Soviets.
Yep.
Now he was going to set the goalpost far enough down the road that they had a chance to win it. So that's one objective. Another piece of this really emerged very quickly. And I'm not sure Kennedy had it in mind when he announced the decision, but certainly within a few months he recognized this was a real issue. In the early 1960s and going back into the 1950s, there were a fairly large number of newly emerging nations, much of them under colonial control until the end of World War II. I like to point to a country like India, which is large, populous, has tremendous resources and capabilities, but at that time, you know, it gained its independence only in 1947. And all of these emerging nations realize that the United States and the Soviet Union are locked in a death struggle. There's no other way to explain it than that's what's happening. You've got a competing political and economic and military system that one is going to win and one is going to lose. And if you're looking around as an emerging nation, non-aligned, you're going to want to throw your lot in and become an ally with the team that's going to win. And they also knew that the future leadership of the world is going to belong to those who can master science and technology. And what is the best demonstration of science and technology you can imagine? And that would be spaceflight. So they're looking at this as a way to sway world opinion to either the, you know, the NATO allies or the Warsaw Pact. And from this standpoint, Kennedy recognized he had a winner. It would help with larger Cold War objectives that the U.S. had underway.
So a way to expand the sphere of influence.
Correct.
Kennedy had one advantage, which is, I suppose, easily overlooked from a distance of 50 years, and that is, perhaps surprisingly, a vice president, but in this case, Lyndon B. Johnson, who was a real master of working Congress.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, he was, and he'd been a very early and able proponent of space exploration. He had been one of the key people who went after the Republicans, especially Eisenhower in the White House at the time of Sputnik, saying, you know, they're not doing enough. We need to do more. He was also one of the advocates for the creation of NASA. As vice president in 1961, he is given the mandate by Kennedy to come up with a space objective. And the mandate was clear. Find me something that we can do in which we can beat the Soviets. And they came up with the Apollo program. Kennedy also relied upon Johnson because of his political acumen to go to Congress and do what he did best, which is to cajole, to probably in some cases threaten, to horse trade, to do all the things necessary to get the votes to support this agenda.
To what extent was it a matter of party politics?
You know, less so than you might think. There were people on both sides of the aisle that thought that this was a good and viable effort. There were those on both sides of the aisle who thought it was a waste of money. Liberal Democrats who thought that we should expend our resources to help the poor or do whatever you want to think of in terms of other sort of social programs. Thought that we ought to expend our resources there and not on Apollo. On the political right, there were those who said, you know, if we're going to spend this money on space, let's spend it on national security. Let's spend it directly for ballistic missiles or something that's got a military mission to it. Or let's give it back to the public as a tax cut. So you find both sides have some adherents as well as some detractors from this agenda. But Johnson did what he did the best. He lined up the coalition necessary to support this. And in fact, there's a great anecdote from after the speech when Kennedy announced the moon landing program on the 25th of May. He's riding back to the White House with Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter. And he turns to Sorensen and he says, you know, I'm not sure Congress is going to go for this. And, you know, they didn't exactly stand up and cheer when I announced it. And indeed, that's correct. I mean, you can watch it on YouTube. And the response is muted at best. And Sorensen said, Mr. President, don't worry. Johnson has got Congress under control. They will vote for this. And he'd done, Johnson had done the head count. He knew that exactly what was necessary, and he had the coalition in place. The funding for NASA for the first year after the Apollo announcement went through very, very easily, and nobody raised serious objections during the debate.
It was a time when some in Congress were pointing to an alleged missile gap between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And to what extent was the space race something that the Soviets were even really participating in? Were they really trying to top the Americans who had come second into the race?
They were. They didn't have an organized program in quite the same way that the Americans had. But the Soviet Union always tried to best the Americans whenever there was a new event. And one of the advantages they had was, since NASA was a sort of a very public program, and its agenda was announced, and the missions were laid out well in advance, the Soviets knew what the Americans were about to do, and they would sneak in sort of at the last minute and do something that would sort of put the limelight back on them. The best example of this I can point to is during Gemini in 1965, they had announced a spacewalk, what would have been the first spacewalk. And that did take place in the summer of 1965 with Ed White undertaking that in the Gemini mission. Just a few months before that, the Soviets launched Alexei Leonov into orbit. He had a space suit. He popped out of the capsule, and he did a little spacewalk just to best the Americans one more time to claim that first. It came out of nowhere from the American perspective, but the Soviets were able to pull it off.
We're going to look more closely at NASA and the technology and the people involved in putting a man on the moon 50 years ago when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Roger D. Launius, the former NASA chief historian and author of the 2019 book Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings, published by Smithsonian Books. Well, we've looked at some of the politics, both national and international, that came into play to develop the space race and this race to the moon. But let's look more closely now at NASA itself. And one of the obviously most important parts of this whole thing of getting a man to the moon or getting even a man into space was incredible development of technology. And it seems to have happened quite quickly once Kennedy issued that challenge of landing a man on the moon by 1969.
Right. Yeah, there's obviously technologies that had to be developed, and one of the most significant was the rocket technology. And they needed a launcher that could hoist the Apollo spacecraft, the lunar module, and basically a service module associated with that to go to the moon. And it was a big rocket, bigger than anybody had ever built before. The Saturn V was under the direction of Wernher von Braun down at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, and then a large contingent of contract talent that was involved in the development of it, and it was no small task. That rocket was remarkable in so many ways. It stood 363 feet tall, much bigger than anything that had ever been built before. It had a thrust capacity at launch of 7.5 million pounds. And that was, again, truly impressive. Now, the Von Braun rocket team had been building rockets since the 1930s. In Germany in 1945, they came to the U.S. They were put to work building ballistic missiles, and they had developed the first sort of a short-range ballistic missile, but nonetheless a ballistic missile that that had some capability, the Thor rockets of the 1950s. That becomes the basis for sort of scaling up this technology. And when I say scaling up, that doesn't do it justice. It's sort of a quantum leap beyond what they had done with those earlier rockets. So it's an impressive, a very impressive feat. And other organizations were also building missiles at the same time. There were rivalries back and forth between these groups, but also a lot of interchange of ideas. And so they all sort of related to each other in pretty fundamental ways. But that Saturn V was remarkable. The Soviets tried to build a comparable rocket. They never got it to work. Fundamentally, that's the reason they did not land people on the moon, and the United States did.
Well, there were, I would assume, two things it had to accomplish. One, it had to achieve escape velocity very quickly. What's that, 17,000 miles an hour or something like that?
Yeah, that's correct. That's orbital velocity, but about 22,000 miles an hour and above will allow you to go to the moon.
And it had to do it without killing the astronaut who was in the space capsule. What kind of technology was required for that?
Well, they built a remarkable engine for the first stage, the F1 engine, that could deliver a lot of thrust. But it was a liquid-fueled engine, and it could be throttled back and forth so you could maintain the G's that would not put the astronauts at risk. One of the real problems that you had prior to this time was you could build a solid propellant rocket that would be able to launch the astronauts, but once you light it, it goes, and whatever that thrust is, it is, and it tended to overwhelm the human body. And the result of that was you did not want to use that type of rocket, a solid propellant rocket, to launch humans. And we don't to this day. Even though there were strap-on solids on the space shuttle, the space shuttle main engine is what really provided the lift necessary to modulate the spacecraft to put the astronauts into orbit. And they only pulled about 3.5 to 4 Gs during launch during the shuttle era. It was higher than that for the Saturn V, but not so high you would smash these guys like bugs against the wall. And that was really significant.
And then the reentry, of course, was another issue, coming back through the Earth's atmosphere without catching fire.
Right. So when you came home from the moon, you had to you were flying at 20,000 plus miles an hour. And you're going to hit the atmosphere, and it's like hitting a wall. And you have to come in at a certain angle, and you have to have a way to slow the spacecraft down. So the astronauts had to be prepared to take a lot of Gs coming home, but it wasn't so high that they passed out or anything like that. And they had to have the excess energy burned off through an ablative heat shield, because they came home so fast, they had to slow down. And once you hit the atmosphere, you start heating up very, very much. And the way to mitigate that was to create a sort of a resin, what they called a heat shield made of resin that would then burn away. And if you see some of the capsules, what you will find is that they have burned, 6 inches or so of depth off of that heat shield as they come home at very high speeds.
Was it a pretty obvious choice to use Navy pilots for the first astronauts?
Well, I mean, Navy pilots have their capabilities, but so does the Air Force, and the Marines, of course, had a pilot, too, in John Glenn. So all of the services get represented, pretty much. The reality is that any of these individuals can do the job. Some of them are maybe more adept at it than some others. And some of them are more thoughtful than others. You know, there's some that are famous for being really great. The pilots had a phrase, a stick and rudder man. Really great sort of nascent pilots. Gus Grissom was in that category.
Good instincts, you mean?
Yeah, very good instincts. And clear-headedness when faced with difficult choices and so forth. Neil Armstrong was not quite in the same category. He was a good pilot, but he was much more of an intellectual type who understood the engineering behind every aspect of the spacecraft. And so he had a different skill set. It was still a very good, useful, important skill set, but it wasn't necessarily the same skill set of the other astronauts.
He was actually a combat pilot, flew, 78 missions in the Korean War.
In the Korean War, that's correct. I mean, and if you want to talk about the film, The Bridges of Toko Ri, that's the guy he was, basically, a person flying those kinds of missions in Korea. He was a war hero, honest to goodness, and had demonstrated his pilot capabilities. But he'd gotten out of the service and had gone to work as a test pilot for the for what became NASA, the NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, and then transferred to NASA. He was an X-15 pilot.
X-15 being high-altitude, high-speed
test vehicle that was used to sort of learn about the supersonic and near-transonic speeds necessary to fly in space.
Well, as long as we're talking about Neil Armstrong, how did the other two astronauts with him for the first moon landing get chosen, and what were their strong points?
Well, I mean, they all have their strengths, and every one of these astronauts, and they will all tell you this, any one of these astronauts could have done the job necessary on Apollo 11. You know, they each had some different skills, obviously, but Deke Slayton, who was head of the astronaut office, made the final selections. Obviously, he talked to people about it higher up in the agency before announcing anything, but he's really the one who was had the responsibility to make crew assignments. And he realized pretty early on that Neil Armstrong is a guy who can command a mission. He has that leadership capability that's necessary to do those sorts of things. And so Neil became a mission commander. Buzz Aldrin had a lot of skills. Being quiet and shy was not one of them. But
so I hear.
But nonetheless, he had a lot of skills and he had a lot of capabilities. And in fact, I would contend that as much as any of the astronauts contributed to the moon landing, Buzz did as much or maybe more in some cases. He had a PhD in astronautics from MIT, and he had studied orbital rendezvous. So he had the knowledge of how to undertake rendezvous and docking in orbit, which was something that NASA had to learn. Nobody knew that when the first astronauts flew in 1961, and it wasn't until the Gemini program of 1965-66 that they got anywhere close to the point where they could do that. And as much as anybody, Aldrin helped them with that because of his background. He also was significant in spacewalking. The first spacewalk in 1965, Ed White sort of floats around outside in the capsule and has a nice time. The second mission, Gene Cernan gets out of the spacecraft, and he has some tasks to perform. He's supposed to go to the back of the Gemini spacecraft and pull out some tools and do some things. And neither the space suit was particularly well made for these things, nor did the spacecraft have handholds that were necessary. And he flailed around trying to perform these tasks and just was unsuccessful at doing it. I mean, the first thing that happened was then his heart rate got up and his breathing got up, and he fogged up the inside of his helmet, so he couldn't see. I mean, it was a very serious issue. He finally got back into the spacecraft, and at that point, NASA knew they had to do something different before they tried this again. But if you can't get out of the spacecraft and do anything, you're not going to really go to the moon. So Aldrin, a few others as well, but Aldrin especially, sort of led an effort by the astronauts to undertake procedures and develop procedures so that they could do spacewalking with a conservation of movement. And they went into a swimming pool and worked on it at what they now call mutual buoyancy simulator, and learned how to do spacewalking. At the same time, they modified the spacesuits so they were more capable of handling what the astronauts had to do. But Aldrin's important in all of that. So he sort of made sense as a guy who would be a member of that crew. In the case of Mike Collins, you've got this very steady individual who has great piloting skills, but who also, and this may be very important, had the psychological capability to sort of sit by himself for hours on end without really having any contact with someone, which was necessary when you're orbiting the moon all by yourself. And he talked about it after the fact that, he never felt so alone in his life. I mean, that's what it was.
He wasn't in contact with either Armstrong or Aldrin or...
Not all of the time. When he was on the other side of the moon, on the back side of the moon, he didn't have contact with anyone.
Did you have a sense that any one of these three, well, let's say Aldrin and Collins in particular, sort of wished that they had been the first to step on the moon?
It's hard to say what they might have wanted in their heart of hearts. The nature of the astronaut corps are all competitive, and so they all want to, be first, be best, whatever, however you choose to define those things. But, if they said that they wanted to be, I haven't seen that. Aldrin, more so than others, was more vocal in his desires, maybe. But even he hasn't said, I should have been first.
There is almost a disconnect between the phenomenal things that these astronauts are doing and the phenomenal places and situations they're in and the very business-like way they have to go about doing it. So there's the Earth rising in the background, but most of the time these astronauts are focused on something far more specific.
Right. Yeah, the flight plan is chock full of activities, and those have to be performed. And the astronauts had checklists, essentially. They would go through this thing. Okay, I'm supposed to do this at a certain time. I'm supposed to do that at another time, and so on. And they would perform those tasks and literally check them off their flight plan at that point. So they're very busy, and they're not just gazing out the window with nothing to do. they did see these opportunities, and so on Apollo 8, when they came around the moon and they saw the Earth off in the distance, and the famous picture of Earthrise is taken at that point. When you listen to the broadcast in the spacecraft, they're all saying, "Oh my goodness, look at that! You're not going to believe this." And so I'm absolutely sure whatever they were doing, they all dropped it and they went there to see, and they somebody yelled, "Hand me a camera! We got to get a picture!" And of course, so they're excited by these things, and they do take advantage of these opportunities, and thank goodness they did. But they're busy all the time.
In retrospect, perhaps long after they had been to the moon, do we have what might be called more rhapsodic or even poetic statements from them?
Oh, sure. And some of them had them at the time. Some of them are as simple as when Buzz Aldrin got out onto the lunar surface, he looked around and referred to it as magnificent desolation, which is sort of a poetic statement, totally apt when you're describing the moon. And I don't know if he thought about that ahead of time or not, but it's certainly an appropriate very short description of what he's seen. And others have been quite eloquent. The most eloquent, in my mind, is people like Mike Collins, who has described what he saw from space in almost a poetic manner, with language that is evocative and very moving.
And that famous statement that we started with from Neil Armstrong, where did that come from? Was that his own, or had somebody suggested it, or what was the source of it?
Well, it was his own. NASA did not script him in that particular way. I'm sure he talked with people about what would be appropriate to say. He wanted, obviously, to say something that would be memorable, and obviously it is. But he sort of flubbed the line.
Sure.
You know, he intended to say that's one small step for a man, and the A sort of got dropped, and, you know, one giant leap for mankind. But, you know, we'll forgive him that. it's not a big deal. It's striking the difference between that statement and the one that Pete Conrad, who was the third man to land on the moon, who got out and got onto the lunar surface on Apollo 12 later in the year in 1969, in which he basically, his first words were, "Whoopee, I made it."
Sure, yeah, it becomes a little bit more mundane by the time you're hitting golf balls on the moon.
Yeah, well, that's true. And Pete also went on to say, that may have been a small step for Neil, but it was a really big one for me.
There's another kind of push-pull thing going on there, and that is, I think the plaque says we come in peace for all mankind, and that's one giant leap for mankind, but then on the other hand, we're planting an American flag.
Right, right. Well, there was a lot of controversy about that. There were people inside of NASA and outside of NASA who thought that we should have planted the UN flag. Some who said, you know, we ought to, you know, take all of the flags of the, you know, all the nations that are a part of the UN or something and plant them or put them there in some way or another. And that debate was actually rousing for a while, but then Congress stepped in and a few weeks before the mission passed legislation that said the only flag going to be put on the moon is the U.S. Stars and Stripes. And that's ultimately what happened. But what I find fascinating about that is that throughout sort of the history of the European expansion around the world where they move into and take over huge chunks of the Americas and Asia and Africa and so forth, the explorer who always set foot on these new lands would plant the flag of the sovereign they served, raise their sword to heaven, and then claim it, claim this territory for the country they represent. The Americans didn't do that, and they consciously did not do that. They did plant the U.S. flag, but the plaque that said, you know, we came in peace for all mankind is very real. That was not lost on these emerging nations. And that was not lost on the other members of the UN and these other nations who saw this take place. It made a difference.
We're going to look at the other aspects of the moon landings and get some ideas to why the last one took place in 1972 and none since. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Roger D. Launius. He's the former chief historian of NASA and the author of the 2019 book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings, published by Smithsonian Books. July 20th, 1969, that first landing on the moon. Neil Armstrong with the famous words, the planting of the American flag, but we come in peace for all mankind. The message going out around the world almost immediately. Then NASA has to figure out how to follow that act in terms of, you know, the great symbolism that they've accomplished and this first great step. They presumably already have something else planned, another moon landing. And what was the strategy behind that?
Well, the second landing, Apollo 12, the first landing was, okay, can we actually do this? And that was the fundamental challenge. And when they did that successfully, they did deploy some experiments on the lunar surface. Those were fairly rudimentary in terms of experiments, but they were of value scientifically, and they collected some samples and so forth. But each mission thereafter becomes progressively more sophisticated. And Apollo 12 was really about a precision landing. Can you land exactly where you want to land? And in that particular flight, Pete Conrad and Alan Bean set down the spacecraft within a few hundred yards of the Surveyor 3 robotic lander that had landed there in 1966. And and part of their task was to walk over to that, take pieces of it off, and bring it home, which they did for analysis to see what happens to various metals, plastics, whatever it happens to be, when exposed to the space environment for a few years. And that was a truly remarkable mission in its own right because of that precision landing. In fact, in the early 1990s, as NASA is negotiating to bring the Russians into the International Space Station, I made trips with delegations to the former Soviet Union, to Russia. And I was talking to some of the engineers at one point who had been involved in their moon program, and they said, you know, we weren't convinced we were beaten with Apollo 11. We thought maybe this is a fluke. Maybe they can't do it again.
Ah, good point.
And but then when they saw Apollo 12 and the precision landing, they said, oh, there's no way we're going to be able to do that. And they knew at that point that it was now something that they had truly lost this race.
They were pretty gracious about it, though, weren't they? I mean, they said something like, well, we're out of the game, but we wish you the best.
Oh, absolutely. And that's certainly true for the space community in the Soviet Union. I mean, just as the American space community wanted to engage in these activities and had no desire and no interest necessarily in all this rivalry between the two nations, that was true for the Russians as well. I mean, you know, they thought this was great from their side. They thought they were going to do good things in their own right. But you know, their colleagues in another country were doing great things, too. And they could totally recognize that.
Now, Kennedy, if I remember early on, said something to the effect of, well, we ought to and can cooperate with the Russians.
Yeah, there were real efforts to, in the Kennedy administration, sort of bring the program together. Just a few days after he announced the Apollo program in 1961, he met Khrushchev for the first and only time in a summit, and he suggested at that meeting, it was sort of an offhand comment, but he suggested, you know, maybe we should do this together. And Khrushchev's response was, well, you know, it's certainly something to take up, and we really need to work on some other more important things like a nuclear test ban treaty and so on and so forth. But nothing came of it. But by the fall of 1963, after walking back from that Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 1962, Kennedy gives a speech in September of 63 and proposes to the UN that the Americans and the Russians undertake a joint program to go to the moon. Who knows what might have happened had he not been assassinated just a couple of months later.
Did that cooperation not come until, what, about 1976 in the bicentennial, or was it before that?
Well, it was a little before that. I mean, the Nixon administration came in January of 1969 with an avowed desire to sort of lessen the tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And the so-called détente of that particular era led to interactions between NASA and the Soviet space program to work together on several things. The most spectacular of those was the 1975 joint Apollo-Soyuz test project, in which American astronauts and Soviet cosmonauts rendezvoused and docked in orbit and engaged in a mission together.
Well, that in itself was a positive outcome of the space race. But there were also people at the time who said, you know, is this going to do that much for anybody on Earth? Is your life really any better for Americans having landed on the moon?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the perennial question. You know, how has my life changed because we went to the moon? And, you know, you can point to some things and you can point to other things. And we learned a ton of new things about the moon itself, its origins, the solar system's origins, and so forth. And from a scientific perspective, it was a treasure trove of new knowledge. Now, that doesn't change, you know, the daily lives of most people, but we're much better off because of that scientific knowledge. Beyond that, I think we can talk about all kinds of things that come out of the Apollo program. We learned to do large, complex programs through this process. And it gave birth to a saying which has been ubiquitous ever since. We can put a man upon the moon, why can't we? You can name the hard problem of your choice. And the reality is, many of those things we can accomplish if we put our mind to it, but it always takes sufficient resources and time. And often we're not willing to invest that time or money to accomplish the big things.
One outcome, I think a fairly immediate outcome and ongoing of that image of the whole Earth was the environmental movement.
That's correct. So the environmental movement is underway at the time, but it is really given a big shot in the arm by two pictures coming out of Apollo. The first is the 1968 Apollo 8 image of Earthrise with the moon in the foreground and the Earth in the background hanging. You know, it's teeming with life. We all know that, and it's hanging in this blackness of space. It really did send the message that the Earth itself is a little spaceship, and there aren't any lifeboats. And it became a powerful symbol for the environmental movement. The whole Earth disk from Apollo 17 did the same thing. It has become the symbol of Earth Day around the globe ever since.
That first moon landing in 1969 took place early in the Nixon administration, and the last one in 1972 also took place in the Nixon administration. Was Nixon not that big a supporter of further moon landings?
Well, no, not really. I mean, you know, Nixon was a practical politician who was happy to take the political benefits associated with this, but it was not something that he viewed as critical to his long-term legacy as president. And I say all that knowing that he went on to shame associated with the Watergate scandal and had to resign. But nonetheless, he didn't dislike it, but he didn't view it as something critical to what he was trying to accomplish in his term as president.
Was the thinking at
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, was the thinking at NASA that the next step really should be a space station?
Well, what they wanted, and they formed at the time, while Apollo was still underway, they formed a space task group with the intention of preparing the next steps in space. And the space task group was under the chairmanship of Spiro Agnew, the vice president for Nixon.
For a while.
And until he had to resign in disgrace. And and it came up with three major objectives. The first was building a space transportation system, which included both a reusable shuttle to go to and from Earth orbit and a space station, and then a base on the moon, and then a mission to Mars. And Nixon looks at this and says, I'm not signing up for this. This is way too big. Tell me what we can do that will reflect positively on the administration, his administration, of course, and will not break the bank. And the result of that was the approval of a space shuttle, which is one of the elements, but only one of the elements in this plan.
There is a big irony in this whole space landing, a moon landing, for you personally, isn't there, in that your grandfather was a a hoax believer? Didn't think it ever happened?
He didn't believe we landed on the moon. Yeah. You know, there were people at the time in 1969 who didn't believe we landed on the moon. One of them was my grandfather, and I can remember talking to him as a kid. And he says, those guys in Hollywood, they can fake anything. You know, they fake this. They don't have the capability to do it. But it's important to understand that his denial of the moon landing was based upon his unsophisticated understanding of science and technology. He was a farmer his entire life, and he always farmed with horses. He never had a tractor, and the way he framed it was, tractors are just a passing fad. So I'm not sure you should rely upon him in taking your cues on whether or not technology is successful or not.
These space goals seem to get dramatically more difficult. Getting a man to the moon is one thing, but now there's talk of Mars, which just seems to be geometrically more difficult than getting a man on the moon.
Yeah, no question about that. Mars is the shiny object that those of us in the space community have wanted to send people to for the longest time. And, of course, we were sort of promised back at the time of Apollo that, yeah, within a few years, certainly by the end of the 20th century, we'll have people on Mars. And, you know, some of us have sort of felt like we've been betrayed because it hasn't happened. But, you know, I'd like to think that it will happen, but whether or not I'll live to see it's another story.
Is it increasingly difficult to fund for that reason? I mean, it's one thing to send out a Pioneer probe or a Voyager probe and not worry too much about, you know, when it's going to actually get there and report back. But when you're talking about sending human beings to Mars in some future lifetime, is it harder to fund that kind of thing?
Well, certainly, it's certainly harder because it's more expensive. We've been very successful in sending probes all over the solar system. And, we've landed rovers on Mars, and they've had a remarkable time doing all kinds of interesting things there and collecting data that's helped us understand that planet much more thoroughly than ever before. But all of those spacecraft are on suicide missions. They're not coming home, and we don't care. But what we do care about is if we're sending a person, the first task of any spacecraft that we send a person in is to bring that person home alive. And that is a much, much more difficult task than robotic spaceflight.
The distance being so much vaster, for one thing, just to get there takes
Absolutely.
How long? A couple of months just to get there?
No. It's more like 8 or 9 months. And if you've got a big rocket, maybe you can get there a little bit faster. But we're talking more than a year to undertake a mission to land humans on the Mars and bring them back.
Roger Lonius, it's been a pleasure talking to you and getting insights, some behind-the-scene insights into the phenomenon of landing astronauts on the moon. So thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.